Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement today by the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, that he will leave the Congress when his term ends in January and speak with a longtime analyst of politics in Wisconsin, Matthew Rothschild, the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, who was previously the editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine in Madison, Wisconsin. He joins us to discuss how Ryan makes much of his personal morality, which does not translate into public morality, since Ryan has never made a stand in the face of Trump's manifest moral turpitude, racism, misogyny, and flagrant dishonesty, and how the deficit hawk exploded the debt with his tax cuts for the rich, while this paragon of family values allowed a reprobate Trump to capture the GOP. With Ryan announcing today that he is resigning because he wants to spend more time with his kids, we'll examine the obvious hypocrisy of this Ayn Rand acolyte's determination to cut programs that allow other parents to spend more time with their kids. We'll also assess the chances of Randy Bryce, the Democratic challenger, hoping to unseat Ryan, and Ryan's Republican challenger, the neo-Nazi and anti-Semite Paul Nehlen. Then, with Trump threatening Russia with schoolboy taunts as he promises to rain missiles and bombs down on Syria, we will examine the possibility of a wider confrontation with Russia breaking out as Trump assembles a coalition of the willing to soon mount a major attack on the Assad regime. Nicholas Harris, a Middle East expert and former Andrew Bacevich USA Fellow at the Center for a New American Security, joins us to discuss whether Russia's threat to attack American missiles and their carriers will mean that U.S. and coalition aircraft will be targeted and Navy ships in the Mediterranean will be fired upon. Then finally, we'll look into the grilling today of Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg before the House Energy and Commerce Committee and speak with Siva Vaidyanathan, Professor of Media Studies and Director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia, and author of the forthcoming book, Antisocial Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. He joins us to assess whether the questions today were more targeted, tech-savvy, and aggressive than what Zuckerberg faced in yesterday's contrition and apology tour before the Senate. And joining us now is Matthew Rothschild, the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, who was previously editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine in Madison, Wisconsin, where he worked for 32 years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rothschild.
It's a pleasure.
So, Matthew, what do you make of the announcement today by House Speaker Paul Ryan that he is resigning, ostensibly to spend more time with his sons? He says that when he was 16, he found his father dead in bed and sort of essentially had to be the breadwinner. I mean, one of the things I find about this man is he's always telling us about his personal morality, but yet it doesn't translate to public morality in the sense that he's never really pulled over Trump. And in effect, he's never made a stand either against candidate Trump or President Trump on moral grounds. And now, of course, Trump has all but captured the GOP.
Yeah, so here we had the captain of the ship jumping off as it's starting to sink before most of the passengers have been able to get to the lifeboats. And that's not exactly our profile in courage. Neither is his position on Donald Trump. I mean, again, today he flunked the morality test when he was asked about Trump and what Trump has done to Washington. He responded all with positives about how grateful he was to Trump for letting him ram, their agenda through. And this is a kind of bizarre pact with the devil that he has made. So anything, there's nothing that Trump could do that would be, would balance out on the negative side the positives in Ryan's mind of giving tax breaks to corporations and getting an estate tax for the super rich. Estate tax break for the super rich. So Trump can destroy our democracy and threaten nuclear war and threaten an escalation of war in Syria and make racist comments and cozy up to neo-Nazis, and all that is okay so long as Paul Ryan gets the tax breaks through Congress, which he's been craving for 20 years. I mean, that is a bizarre and immoral deal to make. And the fact that he was still making that deal today, the day that he announces his retirement, not only from the speakership but from the House, suggests that he still doesn't recognize the moral quicksand that he's been sinking in for the last couple of years.
Well, there was a very effective frontline program last night on PBS on Trump's relationship with the Congress, which profiled both McConnell and Ryan and Trump and their relationship. And initially, Ryan, just when Trump first started out, basically went over to the White House and said, look, you know, we can accomplish great things. We've got the trifecta. We've got the House, the Senate, and the White House. And we're just going to do tax cuts and infrastructure and repeal and replace Obamacare. And it's just going to be amazing. And Trump, of course, doesn't care what they put on his desk as long as he'll sign anything as long as it makes him look good. So he essentially outsourced everything to Ryan. And then Ryan blew it with the repeal and replacement of Obamacare. And then Trump turned on Ryan and McConnell viciously, particularly McConnell, who he screamed at for 40 minutes on the phone, just showering him with expletives. And then at the end of the Frontline special, they show the celebration after they passed the tax cuts for billionaires, where they're all sycophantically praising Trump and congratulating each other. And it's extraordinary how all is forgiven, and Ryan saying Trump's the greatest guy in the world, and so is McConnell, and of course Orrin Hatch said he may end up being one of the greatest presidents ever. It was absolutely sickening.
Well, you know, Paul Ryan lost his moral compass a long time ago when he took going after Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid as one of his career goals at the top of his list. But with Trump, he really lost his moral compass during the campaign when Trump was making racist comments, and Ryan recognized that they were racist, said that they were the textbook definition of a racist comment, and then in the next breath said he was still endorsing this guy for president. That's just a horrible lack of backbone. I mean, he's kind of an invertebrate when you look at him closely. And, you know, I was in some local TV studio the night of the election, and what a dismal night that was. And I remember hearing Paul Ryan say, "This is a good night for America." And all I could think of was, actually, this may be good night America. And that's what we're seeing right now. The threats to our very democracy, the threat to world survival, not only with global warming that's accelerating under Trump, but with the nuclear saber rattling on the Korean Peninsula, and then tweeting this morning about missile to Russia about we're going to send in some nice new smart missiles, beware. That is infantile or adolescent male behavior that is totally out of keeping with what we need as a president. But here we are, and Paul Ryan is standing at the podium silent about all that today. Today was a chance for him to, rediscover a backbone, but he was unable to find it. And so he's just kind of slinking away.
And again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and he was previously editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine in Madison, Wisconsin, where he worked for 32 years. Let's turn to the Democratic challenger for Paul Ryan's seat in nearby Janesville, where Randy Bryce, otherwise known as a Twitter handle Einstash, the iron worker with the mustache, who's running a very creative campaign and doing very well. Does that mean that the coast is clear for him? Because won't he be running against the guy, the Republican, who's going to be replacing Paul Ryan, is a neo-Nazi, isn't he, Paul Nehlen?
Yeah, Paul Nehlen's a neo-Nazi, but I wouldn't be surprised if tomorrow, or certainly by Monday, we see a more reputable Republican, a state legislator, join the race. I don't think the Republican Party is going to sit still for that anti-Semite. You mentioned Stosh. It's not clear that he's got a direct path, Randy Bryce, to even the nomination. There's a primary with a woman named Kathy Myers, who is a successful Army Reserve nurse turned into a truck stop owner, and she's running a campaign against Randy Bryce. If I had to guess, I would say Randy Bryce is likely to win the primary. But this district is a district that tends to be Republican these days, went pretty strongly for Trump. You know, there is a blue wave that's been splashing onto Wisconsin here recently, and maybe it'll take that district down, and maybe it'll be possible for Iron Stosh there to win the seat. But it's not a given, just as it's not a given that Scott Walker is going to lose for governor in November here.
And you're referring, Matthew Rothschild, to the recent election where a liberal judge is now on the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Absolutely. And she won a tremendous victory. She won in counties that went for Trump. And she did extremely well in Dane County, where I am, you know, getting 81% of the vote, which is, even for liberal Dane County, pretty astonishing. And if you even took Dane County out of it, you know, she still was head-to-head with the conservative hack she was running against. So, her name is Justice Dallet, and she won a surprise victory. And then there was a surprise victory in Trump territory in a state Senate district in northwestern Wisconsin in February. So, you know, the Republican forces here in Wisconsin are 0-2 recently, and maybe Paul Ryan, you know, was reading the tea leaves and thought, you know, he might lose his seat in the election, or that Republicans are going to lose the majority in the House of Representatives, so he'd no longer be Speaker, and that wouldn't be much fun, and decided, you know, get out while the getting's good. And maybe he didn't want to be standing there when Mueller delivered the document to the House of Representatives that there's cause for impeachment, because that is coming. And it's going to be a real test of our democracy and a test of the Republican Party to see what they do with that possible indictment.
Well, before that happens, there's a strong likelihood that Trump will either fire Rod Rosenstein or Jeff Sessions or both of them.
Yeah, or try firing Mueller directly, which is what Sarah Huckabee Sanders was saying he had the right to do yesterday. I've always thought that he was going to get rid of Mueller and or pardon everybody under the sun, and he may do both. And then we really do have a constitutional crisis, because it will be blatantly clear that we have a president who's obstructing justice and thinks that he's above the law. I mean, my God, he was saying earlier this week that when the FBI went to his lawyer's office, that was an attack on the United States. I mean, he thinks his interests are identical to those of the United States. This is the way a monarch thinks. This is l'état, c'est moi. This is Louis XIV, for God's sakes. And, you know, that's not democracy. And at some point, even people in the Republican Party are going to need to stand up for democracy, or we're not going to have one.
Well, that was pretty much the subtext of the Frontline special last night on Trump's relationship with Congress. At the end of the day, both McConnell and Ryan were so weak that they never resisted Trump, either as a candidate or as a president, or never stood up for traditional Republican values, and at the end allowed him to essentially capture the Republican Party in alliance with the kind of Tea Party wing. And it's, you know, basically an extremely right-wing nativist party now. And I don't know where it's heading, particularly with if Trump, its stand-and-bearer, crashes and burns. But the implication is that it didn't have to happen, and these weasels allowed it to happen. Is that what's your take? I guess you didn't see the front line.
No, but look, I mean, I have respect for people like Jeff Flake and John McCain, who've been speaking up, or intellectuals like George Will or David Frum, who've been speaking up. But those who haven't been are going to be accountable if worse comes to worse here. And it is a risk. I mean, when a former Secretary of State, not my biggest, not the person I respect the highest, Madeleine Albright, is going onto the New York Times talking about the risk of fascism in the United States, using the F word, you know, we are further down the slope already than we should be, than is comfortable being. And democracies don't last sometimes forever, and they can go south real fast. I mean, Germany was the height of Western civilization, philosophy, art, music, literature, and look what happened there less than 100 years ago. Chile was a democracy for 100 years, and it died in a night 45 years ago. So, look, we shouldn't be so secure in our ballyhooed checks and balances, because that system may not be as secure as we think. We have a guy here who fantasizes about being president for life.
Well, he is obviously, at least to my mind, guilty of something. And an innocent man would not be behaving the way he does. And as you say, he recently suggested that the FBI raid on his lawyer was an attack on our country, when it is Trump himself who is attacking the rule of law in our country. And I'm astounded that people don't see through this man, through his obvious trapped animal antics, that he's just terrified that, in fact, at the end of the day, we may find out that he's not only a criminal, but he may well be in the pocket of a hostile foreign leader.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he's in hock to Russian oligarchs who've funded his enterprises when he couldn't get any money from Wall Street because he was such a risk. And that's always been the reason he didn't release his tax returns, it seems to me. But I'm less concerned about the Russian influence over Trump than I am about Trump becoming essentially a dictator here and appealing to people in the way that Hitler and Mussolini did, with two appeals. One is to racism, and he's been doing that. You know, he's done it his whole life, but the birther movement, Charlottesville especially, his attack on Mexicans and Muslims that continue ad nauseum, that's one part of it. And the other part is his ultra-nationalism. I mean, that's what Make America Great Again. It's nothing but an appeal to people's sense of bereaved patriotism, and that appeal was central to Hitler's rise to power, central to Mussolini, central to Franco, central to Pinochet. And when you combine those two, I mean, racism and ultranationalism are the sperm and the egg of fascism that's, you know, nourished in the toxic womb of capitalism. And that's where we are right now. And we got to recognize the real risks we have. Democracy is, on a shoestring right now, hanging by a thread. And we've got to get out in the streets and support it, and we've got to try to shake some sense into the few remaining decent Republicans to speak up about this imminent threat to our democracy.
Well, Matthew Rothschild, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Take care.
And you too. And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, who was previously editor and publisher of The Progressive magazine in Madison, Wisconsin, where he worked for 32 years. We're going to take a brief station break back, examining the possibility of a wider confrontation with Russia since Trump is threatening them with schoolboy taunts. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, who's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, working in the Middle East Security Program. From 2016 to 2017, Nicholas served as the Andrew Basevich USA Fellow at the Center for New American Security. He's also a senior analyst at the Jamestown Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based global research and analysis institute, and he's the author of From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me.
And President Trump is, I think, basically taunting the Russians. You know, the Russian defense minister warned that the Russians would respond to American missiles and go after the missiles and their carriers, which could mean the destroyers off in the Mediterranean firing the cruise missiles, if that's a part of what is in the planned attack, which I imagine is looming at any moment. Today, the president tweeted out, Russia vows to shoot down any and all missiles fired at Syria. Get ready, Russia, because they will be coming, nice and new and smart. You shouldn't be partners with a gas-killing animal who kills his people and enjoys it. So that's pretty rough language, certainly undiplomatic. Not that I entirely disagree with the last part about Assad, frankly, but not what you normally hear. And this is a tense situation. So is, to your mind, is Donald Trump pouring oil on the fire here?
President Trump is taking this situation personally. He's taken the Duma attack that happened over the weekend personally. You know, President Trump is a man who learns visually. And the images that came out of Duma over the weekend resembled images that came from Han Shehun a year ago, which prompted President Trump to order cruise missile strikes on the Syrian military base at al-Shayrat. You know, there is a sort of history here, Ian, and it's a recent history. For the last month, President Trump, who has a very close relationship with U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, has essentially been asking Ambassador Haley to put Russia on notice in the United Nations Security Council regarding the situation in the East Ghouta near Damascus, in particular in the context of allowing humanitarian access for civilians. Russia could not move Assad, really, by and large, to accomplish that. And, you know, this has been a simmering issue. And I think, you know, the real spark were the images that came out this weekend. And I think what you see from the way President Trump has executed his messaging is that, you know, he is personally offended by Vladimir Putin. And he's personally offended that the Russian generals on the ground in Syria can't manage Assad and Assad's forces. And you get the sense that not only is this a personal, you know, he's taken this personally, but he is now in a pattern where he's trying to show Bashar al-Assad, but also Vladimir Putin, who's boss.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, working in the Middle East Security Program. From 2016 to 2017, Nicholas served as the Andrew Bacevich USA Fellow at the Center for New American Security. He's also a senior analyst at the Jamestown Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based Global Research and Analysis Institute, and he's the author of From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition. Well, but he's also violating something that he's often said, which you should never tip your hand, and everything's on the table, but we won't say what we're going to do. Well, he's more or less saying what we're going to do by implication that this is going to be a bigger attack than the one a year ago, and I don't see how he can back down and do something similar to the 59 cruise missiles that attacked the Syrian airbase and obviously didn't deter the future behavior of Bashar al-Assad.
It didn't. You know, and it's interesting that you bring this up, Ian, because, you know, and Bashar al-Assad is still in power because he is a clever leader, and he's very cleverly played every advantage he's had, whether it's been military, demographic, or in terms of great power support, to stay in power. And what Bashar al-Assad took from the strikes last year, what the Russians probably told him, because the Russians talked to the Americans every day, is that there is a threshold, and the Americans have decided that, you know, chemical weapon use lower than nerve agents won't merit a U.S. response, because institutionally, the U.S. military does not want to be the policeman of Syrian conflict. They don't want to launch strikes every time Assad does something heinous. And I know that sounds so cold-blooded, but it's true. There's an institutional awareness within the U.S. military that U.S. resources for Syria are limited. Fundamentally, the U.S. wants to focus on eastern Syria and the counter-ISIS campaign. It doesn't want to have to be involved so much in the western Syria and the active civil war there between Bashar al-Assad and his allies and the armed opposition. And that, and from a strategic perspective, President Trump himself and his senior leaders want to shift attention to Asia and to the Korean Peninsula, where the Trump administration assesses that the gravest and most imminent threat to the U.S. homeland, perhaps an existential threat, emanates from. And so this is where we're in this, we're very interested in time right now, because, you know, Ian, I look at President Trump's his messaging. And I also look at sort of the senior military leadership and Secretary of Defense Mattis. And it seems that President Trump has his message in, but his senior defense and military leaders are walking in step with him. You don't see the same type of leaks coming out of the Pentagon or the National Security Council saying that there's this major dissent against what President Trump is doing. And I do wonder if just broadly the U.S. government's tired by Assad's antics and view this as an opportunity to try to get Russia to not only rein Assad in, but to get serious about, okay, how do you work pragmatically forward to get to a solution to the Syrian conflict?
Well, I think early in the war, during the Obama administration, I think it was the former French president, Sarkozy, and the Saudis were prepared to launch attacks against all of Assad's palaces, and they wanted the U.S. to give them air cover and suppress the ground-to-air missiles, and apparently Obama did not agree to that. If there is to be a symbolic attack on all of Assad's palaces, etc., or something like that, surely it's not going to be that easy unless they use cruise missiles, because the Israelis just attacked some Iranian IRGC, a drone activity on an airbase, and they lost one of their jets. They didn't lose the pilot. If they did lose the pilot and he'd been captured, I'm sure we'd be already in a much more combative situation. But that would indicate to me that these Russian ground-to-air missile batteries are pretty effective.
Well, Russia has advanced anti-air missile systems that it has in western Syria, and they're there to, you know, not only protect Russia's air base at Hammamim in Latakia province, and also Russia's naval base in Tartus, but also to protect the core area of Bashar al-Assad's power, which is central western Syria. It's interesting because, you know, this is a great point you raise, Ian, because, you know, the Israelis pretty consistently over the last few years have been able to conduct airstrikes against targets that they believe to be supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon, primarily targets that are Iranian or Hezbollah targets in western Syria. And there is some question to the extent to which it's possible that the Russians who maybe operate in these air defense systems have sort of dropped the shield in order to send a signal to the Iranians that their agenda and Russia's agenda are not the same in Syria. In this case, I think, you know, what we'll have to look for is, you know, what happens with this coalition of the willing that seems that President Trump and his team are trying to assemble. You know, you have President Macron from France, who is there, you know, right alongside President Trump. It looks as if British Prime Minister Theresa May might actually have political capital to use to get the United Kingdom involved. You've seen Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Australia, some other partners, discussing that they'd be willing to support the United States. And this is an important point, because in order to carry out what is referred to as saturation strikes, which means, you know, not just cruise missiles but also aircraft, because the cruise missiles and some aircraft are needed to take out air defenses, and then aircraft and other cruise missiles come in to hit the targets. And in order to do those types of strikes, you need more time, you need more resources. And one way to get more resources into the Middle East without having to shift major U.S. forces that would otherwise be focused on North Korea is to create a coalition of the willing. I think that's the most important factor here, is that if there is a military strike that's ordered by President Trump. It will be conducted as part of a multinational coalition of the willing.
Well, that appears to be what's happening now, that they're gathering this coalition of the willing. So that would mean that nothing's going to happen for a few days. Would that be your analysis?
I think it's likely that we're going to be in a hold-in pattern, and the reason for that is, yes, you need to assemble this coalition, the Willen. I also believe that there is a sort of very robust back channel that's going on between the United States and Russia about the way forward, and that, you know, the United States is not necessarily fully committed to a military option, but they're going to give time for Russia to demonstrate that it's gotten the message, because it's about Russia. This is less about Assad. This is about Russia. And so I think that this is an important, point that, you know, if there is a military strikes that are conducted, they will not only impact Assad, but they're meant to have Russia feel pain as well.
But I don't see, and we talked about this earlier, Nick, I don't see how Trump can back down from his rhetoric. He basically has always prefaced it by saying Obama was weak and he drew a red line and then he caved. I'm not going to do that. And his tweets today are even more inflammatory, basically taunting the Russians. So it'd be hard for me to see how he could basically back down unless there was some big deal. But remember, the big deal that Obama made with the Russians over getting rid of the chemical weapons, well, look how good that one was.
Well, and, you know, you only get the Russians to feel the pain if they have to support the weight of Assad. And, you know, in order to accomplish that mission, you have to significantly degrade what remains of Assad's military resources, which means at the bare minimum, you hit most all of his air bases in central western Syria. You hit potential or known chemical weapons factories. You might also hit Assad family economic resources. You might hit, you know, known sites where they draw income from in order to also, you know, put some pain on Assad. And, you know, this is why, you know, the situation right now is very dynamic. And, you know, from the big picture, this will only work successfully for the United States if Assad's war machine is ground down, or it creates the conditions whereby Russia would consider an alternate to Assad.
Well, Nicholas Harris, I thank you for your analysis, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, working in the Middle East Security Program. From 2016 to 2017, Nicholas served as the Andrew Basevich USA Fellow at the Center for New American Security. He's also a senior analyst at the Jamestown Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based global research and analysis institute, and he's the author of From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the grilling today of Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg before the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Siva Vaidyanathan, who is a professor of media studies and director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. His forthcoming book is titled Antisocial Media: How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Siva
Vaidyanathan.
Thank you. And it seems today's hearings before the House Energy and Commerce Committees, yesterday, of course, half the U.S. Senate grilled Mark Zuckerberg, with the exception, perhaps, of the senator from Illinois, Dick Durbin, who I thought asked a very trenchant question about what hotel did Zuckerberg stay in last night. There was a sense that the senators may not know the issues and they really weren't asking the right question. That's certainly a lot of people in the tech world have made that criticism. Do you think the House congressman today did better?
Oh, definitely. So today in the House, it's not so much that they did better. I think they had a different role, and they were following up on the set and tone of questions that came from the Senate on Tuesday. So on Tuesday, senators generally approached Zuckerberg with the general. Most of the questions were sort of big picture. Talk about the role that Facebook plays in our electoral system. Talk about the role that Facebook plays in the data collection and advertising technology world. There were so many senators who were interested in fairly predictable issues, but you know that's to be expected. I thought what happened was that most of these House members, or at least their staffs, watched the Senate hearings rather intently and were able to fashion much more pointed questions. There also were a handful of members today on Wednesday who actually knew quite a bit about the operations of Facebook. In many cases, seem to understand the operations of Facebook better than Mark Zuckerberg does. One of the things we have to remember is that rarely does a CEO, a chief executive officer of an American company, master the details of that company in terms of like the vastness of its interactions. One of the things we have to remember when we're talking about Facebook is that it is vast and it is weird. It is a company unlike any other. It's a company that affects our lives in ways that are unlike any other. Its closest cognate is Google, but even then, we use Google and Facebook very differently in our lives. So it's been clear to me for some time that since Sheryl Sandberg joined Facebook around 2010, maybe a bit earlier, Mark Zuckerberg has been the big ideas guy, and Sheryl Sandberg has actually run the company and run it in extremely effective ways, right? Facebook has turned from a massive money loser into a massive money winner in remarkably short time. It only took about 24 or 36 months for Sheryl Sandberg to turn around the fortunes, literal fortunes of Facebook. She devised this advertising system that is the envy of the world and in many ways the most powerful and influential advertising system in the world. And she made sure that the company's, public affairs, public relations wing is effective and made sure that its personnel offices are effective, in just every single way you would expect a chief operating officer to operate. She has, and she's excelled at it. So Zuckerberg is probably the wrong person to have in that chair. He is the public face of the company because he's often called upon to outline the big idealistic vision of the company. But in reality, these questions are not at all about the vision of the company. They are much more about the details, about the ways that Facebook has, violated the Federal Trade Commission's consent decree from 2011, which is something Facebook's lawyers can answer. Maybe some of the project directors can answer, and Sheryl Sandberg could certainly answer. But Mark Zuckerberg seems to not have been briefed on that issue at all, even though it's been a rather hot issue for the last few weeks. Zuckerberg seems not to grasp the simple fact, or want to at least admit the simple fact, that Facebook tracks Facebook users when they're not on Facebook, when they've logged off of Facebook, and perhaps more importantly, Facebook gathers data on people who have never signed up for Facebook. You know, that is, those are two simple facts of how Facebook operates in the world, and every time he's asked about that, often by some very informed members of Congress, he will not simply say, yes, we do that. You know, instead he wants to dodge it, hem and haw, and explain that it's all about security, when in fact it is not at all about security.
And again, I'm speaking with Siva Vaidyanathan, who's a professor of media studies and director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. His forthcoming book is titled Antisocial Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. Now, in terms of a tough question, I thought today from in the House hearings, Representative Bobby Rush of Democrat of Illinois accused Zuckerberg of and Facebook of, quote, wholesale invasion and manipulation of users' rights to privacy. What is the difference between Facebook's methodology and the methodology of the American political pariah J. Edgar Hoover? That was maybe somewhat overstated, but nevertheless, yeah. You know, you really at the heart of this is the questions about the business model of surveillance capitalism, which, of course, Alphabet, Google also practice. Do you think there's a public awakening that you get nothing for free in this life, and if you essentially use these so-called services, you become the product, and you get monetized, but you get none of the money?
There's growing awareness of that relationship, and that's healthy. But we also have to remember that it can't be about us as individuals, right? This problem is not about how Facebook treats me or how it treats you. It's about how Facebook treats millions of people, especially billions of people who live outside the United States, who are not engaged in this barrage of information and criticism that Americans are privileged to right now. And look, it's not like even the barrage of information and criticism is likely to get through to a majority of Americans or a majority of Facebook users in America. Facebook is a global company and one in which every day the United States matters less. Right now, the United States matters significantly for two reasons. One, it's where the most valuable Facebook users live. So each of us in the United States generates much more revenue for Facebook than a user in Egypt or a user in Nigeria or Brazil. However, that's not going to hold true forever, right? That will even out over time. And you can make up for that with numbers. So for instance, in the United States, Facebook has about 220 million users. That's about 65% of the American population. So that's a pretty healthy number, and it's leveled off. It doesn't look like Facebook has much room for growth in the United States. In India, Facebook already has 30 million more users. They have 250 million users in India. That is only one quarter of the population of India. So the potential for growth and the rate of growth in India is so much more. And assuming that India's economy grows, it continues to grow at a much faster rate than the United States, as it has for the last 20 years, we can be fairly sure that 20 years from now, Facebook users in India will be a lot closer to the value of Facebook users in the United States. But given the fact that there are already 250 million users in India, not only is the future of Facebook in India, the present of Facebook is in India. So, yes, I'm heartened by the fact that there is better public awareness in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in Western Europe, and to a large degree in Australia, but that's not really where the battle has to be fought. We really need global awareness of this problem, this industry, and Facebook specifically. I think we have a lot more work to do to make sense of the influence that Facebook has in the world.
But in general, it seems that we always go back to the Communications Act that Bill Clinton signed. I think it's the
Communication Decency Act, yes.
Right.
Section 230, yes.
Section 230, right. So we're just the pipe. We're not responsible for what goes down the pipe.
Right.
So how do you navigate that? You're a former journalist. So
sure.
We learn.
Well, so just, back in the 1990s, there was a Congress had an a reason, a justification for making sure that people could confidently invest in internet service without fear that they would be held legally responsible for all of the nonsense and bad things that, you know, we were likely to do with these services. So it's a principle that extends way back to the telephone. We, you know, we don't hold the telephone companies responsible for the bank robberies that were arranged over the telephone, or the gambling that was arranged over the telephone, or any number of bad acts that had been planned over the telephone. We hold the carrier above liability, or exempt the carrier from liability. It's not a bad principle of communication. So the idea was that we don't want internet service providers to fear the same thing, because if they fear that, two things will happen. One, they will refuse service to anybody who they might consider suspect, and that means they might redline vast communities out of internet service. That was one fear. The second fear is they would have an incentive to monitor everything we do and make sure that we did not misbehave and cancel service for those who misbehaved. Well, two things have changed since then. One, the very idea of an internet service provider, in the 1990s, they had in mind AOL or any number of dial-up services providing service, right? And those things were comparable to phone companies. They could not, in the 1990s, envision something like Facebook, and the fact that Facebook would be defined as an internet service provider for these purposes. Secondly, we ended up with a situation where the company, at least in Facebook and Google's case, they actually do know everything we do. So we didn't avoid the surveillance problem in the first place. So there may be reason to re-examine at least the extent to which Section 230, which provides this legal exemption, extends to companies like Facebook and Google, largely because they are different animals than what Congress envisioned in 1996. So we are talking about a completely different process. I think it's worthy of consideration. However, I don't think that's the key to the problems that Facebook has put up. Look, if we took away that exemption and we made Facebook legally liable for all of the instances of malfeasance on its platform, that would not make Facebook clean up propaganda, misinformation, disinformation, because those aren't legally problematic in the United States. We have the First Amendment, right? So they would still be protected by the First Amendment. We might find Facebook legally liable for libel if someone actually commits libel on Facebook, but that is not likely to happen very often because it's very hard in the United States to demonstrate libel anyway. It's a very rare cause of action, and usually it's a cause of action against an egregious incident and a wealthy party. But, you know, there would be some nuisance and harassment suits based on that. You know, it would be a bit of a mess, and it wouldn't bring down Facebook, nor would it necessarily address the problems that we see. So I don't really think the Section 230 problem is that crucial.
And again, I'm speaking with Siva Vaidyanathan, who's a professor of media studies and director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. His forthcoming book is titled, well, what about the fact that between 2/3 and 3/4 of Americans apparently get their news and information via Facebook? And what happened in the election was, in the run-up to the elections, was that Zuckerberg was buffaloed by right-wing activists, we're not quite sure who, very thinly sourced, saying that that Facebook, in terms of the human curation of the news, has a liberal bias. The same question, by the way, that Senator Cruz asked yesterday. It's right. Completely absurd, because all these titans in Silicon Valley are mostly libertarian. But the long and the short it was, Zuckerberg rolled, got rid of the human curators, brought in the algorithms, Cambridge Analytica, the Republicans and company, Bannon, Jared Kushner, you name it, they were ready to roll, and they absolutely gamed the algorithms with fake news, and the bots from Russia multiplied the effect, and we know what happened in terms of the election. So, and 87 million users of Facebook had their data basically manipulated.
Yes.
So,
two things.
So what do you do about that?
There's not much we can do about that. So the complaints that conservatives raised about Facebook curation, that had to do with the trending topics feature that Facebook was running in a way of mimicking Twitter. It really had nothing to do with the main news feeds that people see, which is where our eyes go when we tune into Facebook. We tend to go to the newsfeed rather than trending topics. So what had happened was a few former employees of Facebook complained to right-wing sites that they had been asked to limit the reach of conservative sources on trending topics. But, you know, the thing is, maybe they were asked to limit the reach of hate speech or limit the reach of white supremacist content, and that was being interpreted properly or not as conservative. Who knows, right? But the change that Facebook made was to make the trending topics purely algorithmically driven. The news feed, the thing that really matters on Facebook, that was always algorithmically driven. That was always a reflection of the level of engagement or the amount of response that a post generates, and by whom, response from whom. So that has always been a problem. It's been a problem because what generates response? Things that trigger emotions. So what triggers strong emotions? Well, any picture of a cute puppy, but also hate speech and conspiracy theories and, you know, all sorts of other, you know, nasty things will generate response, both positive and negative. If I posted something on my Facebook wall, some nonsense about, you know, about denying climate change or claiming falsely that vaccines cause autism, I would immediately get a number of comments from friends saying, right on. But I would get even more from friends saying, what are you talking about? This stuff is nonsense. Don't spread it around. But every one of those comments, Facebook reads as engagement. It doesn't score it positively or negatively. It scores it as engagement. So the more interaction that post gets, the farther that post travels, and the more often it shows up on people's news feeds, and the higher it shows up on people's news feeds. And that means that I would have, that post would have disproportionate power. Whereas if I posted something completely reasonable, completely rational, examining some facet of the Italian economy, you know, some article from the Economist or something, that would not generate strong emotions. It would generate a handful of clicks and likes, but nothing strong, and that post would die a quick death. So reasonable, well thought out, measured items never travel very far on Facebook. But the crazy stuff travels on Facebook. It just so happens that we're in a position in the United States where most of the crazy stuff is coming from the right, often the scary extreme racist right. And so the anecdotes about stuff being blocked tend to come from the right. That's where we are right now. It's an unfortunate situation. Now, Facebook can't do anything about that without completely altering the nature of Facebook. This is why I say that the problem with Facebook is Facebook. It is so deeply embedded in the nature of the company, in the nature of the algorithm, that to ask for something different, some other system, is to ask Facebook not to be Facebook. And I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Well, just in closing, I don't know how the Delete Facebook movement is doing and how it will do, but there's no question to my mind that it would be a good thing if people spent less time living in cyberspace and more time with human interaction. I mean, I don't know whether you recall the famous Norman Rockwell picture of the family sitting around the Thanksgiving table. Today, everybody sitting around the Thanksgiving table will be looking at the palm of their hand. And you see that so often, particularly with young people. They spend most of the time looking at their palms rather than looking at people sitting opposite them or interacting. So do you think that the extent to which this is just a symptom of a broader issue is at play here?
there are many broader issues at play, and it is a symptom of many broader issues. So, you know, look, over the past 20 years, we have steadily moved more of our lives, more of our minutes, more of our attention, and more of our important interactions to these tiny devices that walk around with us. We strap them to our skin. We sleep next to them, sometimes with them. And that is deeply unhealthy. It creates massive distortion in terms of what is important in the world. And we surrender our judgment to the algorithms that dictate what flows across these screens. That's deeply unhealthy, and it's the sort of problem from which all of these other Facebook externalities flow. And the only way to address the problems that Facebook creates is to address our own susceptibility, our own weaknesses, our own willingness to outsource judgment to companies like Facebook and Google. That's basically an unhealthy process. But we have managed to turn all of our policy, all of our passion, all of our excitement, in many ways unleashed the brightest of our young people on trying to find better ways to sell ads on Facebook and Google. And that's just, it should make us ill. And we're seeing the fallout of it. We're seeing the deep degradation of the instruments of democracy and the institutions that make a republic able to function. So we really do need to reinvest in those institutions, in those practices. We have to rehumanize ourselves. That has to be job number one. That doesn't reduce our call for implementing the kind of regulation that can rein in the power of Facebook or the power of Google. That is all necessary anyway. But beyond that, I think we really have to check ourselves and say, is this truly how we want to live our lives in the future? Do we truly want to render judgment or outsource our best judgment to these algorithmic companies that will exploit our data for their own purposes?
Well, Steve Vardianassian, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Siva Vaidyanathan, who is a professor of media studies and director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. His forthcoming book is titled Antisocial Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.